So, we've been talking a lot about
Chitti, joy.
Yeah.
A lot of it's been fairly theoretical.
But, any questions or comments? Yes?
Question. I heard people mention about ecstasy.
Ecstasy.
That's strong joy. Mm-hmm. Is a part of we talked about yesterday, that's very intense, that one is called that, or that is the need to go to a deep jhana in order to experience that?
Well,
what's that?
People sort of struggled with the right word to use to translate the particular kind of PT that arises in meditation. And they sometimes translate it as rapture and bliss and ecstasy and things like that. Really, what you have to keep in mind when you hear these words being used, if you understand what it is, it's a joy that is unusual in that it doesn't originate with things outside of you. It's internally generated as a result of the meditation process. And of course it comes with all of these other things that we've talked about. But yeah, sometimes it can be very intense. And so people do try to choose words that make it clear that when they're talking about the state of joy as piti, that it is not just your ordinary, everyday joy. And so they'll use words like ecstasy. The fact is that in the deep jhana, there's, as I said last night, piti comes, it's very intense, even disturbingly so, there's a lot of energy. As your ability to let that energy flow inside of you increases, everything quiets down. And the state of joy retains all those characteristics that we talked about. Maybe it's time to do a quiz. Do you remember what the characteristics of the state of joy are? What effect does it have on your attention?
Highly focused.
Highly focused, yes. It makes your attention more focused, and if your attention is more focused, it comes over. What I was actually getting at is when you're in a state of joy, and whether you're sitting in meditation or not, it tends to make you selectively more likely to attend to that which is good, beautiful, wholesome. Right? So because you can't take everything in. Everything's always filtered. And your states of mind, of which PT is one, filters the input. Or another way of thinking of it is it has an influence on where your attention is directed. So one characteristic of PT is that it causes you to tend to notice those things that are more pleasant, more attractive, more beautiful, good, whatever positive words you want to attach to it. Secondly, it has an effect on how you perceive them, right? Remember the half full, half empty thing? So you tend to perceive that likewise in the most positive terms. So you see the glass as half full rather than half empty, or neither full nor empty. You see the fullness aspect of it. And the third quality of joy in general, and PT as well, is that it affects the kind of feeling, the vedana, that is elicited by whatever it is you happen to be paying attention to. So that things that are slightly pleasant are strongly pleasant, things that would otherwise be neutral are pleasant, things that would be slightly unpleasant or neutral, it shifts everything in that direction. So these are the three qualities. Okay, back to what I was saying. PT has this intensity, a lot of energy. When the energy begins to flow, the intensity of the PT subsides. But it continues to be PT, and it still continues to have these same qualities. But as the intensity subsides, it permits tranquility and equanimity to coexist in your mind. Right? So this the subsidence of intensity is important to allow this tranquility to be present. And now, when PT arises in the normal course of improving concentration and developing samatha, it starts out really intense and then it tends to quiet down and takes on the additional qualities of tranquility and equanimity, and it becomes a more serene kind of PT. Now, if the meditator then uses that concentration and that samatha as an access for the deep absorptions, then these deep absorptions are once again going to have the effect of intensifying the PT. If you think of it that in terms that I first introduced this to you, that it seems to be the unification of our mind, of all these different processes that make up our mind, as they start to function more harmoniously, and you know, more in sync with each other. This is what causes this state to exist and this subjective experience of joy to be present. So we can just sort of correlate those two and say, the more unified your mind is, the more joy you're going to experience. And if you've been operating at a certain degree of unification of mind, we'll just make up something. Say you're, you know, you've gone from, you know, 19%, which was your daily life, up to 63%, which is what you get when you've been meditating for a few days in retreat, you get a lot more joy. If you stay at that for a while, then you get used to that, kind of tones down a little bit. You go into a deep jhana, then the degree of unification of your mind is much more profound. That is the very nature of jhana, absorption, is that essentially you're saturating the bandwidth of your capacity for consciousness with whatever it is you've selected to focus on. You've kind of filled it up. And this has the sort of beneath the surface effect of causing all of those subconscious parts of your mind to come together even more strongly than before. So the result of practicing deep jhanas is that you'll get another increase in the intensity of the PT that you experience. So jhanas, but you also go through the same process. You begin to accommodate that, and as a matter of fact, the agitation of the PT gets tiresome, and you look forward to it calming down and getting to the tranquility and so forth. But in the course of your practice, if you have an insight experience, if in the course of your practice you have a sudden realization, and not a conceptual one, I'm talking about, you know, a more experiential insight, that then very often that's going to trigger another really strong surge of PT. Because, you know, it's enhancing that same process once again. And then, of course, the ultimate insight experience is the one that you have when you have, at least for a short period of time, a much more profound realization of the true nature of reality and the illusory nature of yourself that you cling to. And that is a jhanic experience, even though it might only last a few seconds or might last 20 minutes, but for whatever period it lasts, it is going to be an extremely powerful jhanic experience. And so, once again, it's going to be followed by joy, bliss, the qualities that are usually described as the fruition experience. So people will use the labels like ecstasy and rapture and things like that, to try to indicate that how special whatever it is they're talking about is. And so if somebody has been using the word rapture to describe the PT that is experienced on entering the deep jhanas and experience in the first two jhanas, and then they go on to talk about the blissful experience of fruition following path attainment, they might say, well, you know, it's really not the same. I need a different word. Go through the thesaurus and say, oh, ecstasy, that's it. And ecstasy is actually a really appropriate word because it relates somewhat to the cause in this particular instance. Because ecstasy means to stand outside of. And one of the qualities of this experience is that for some indefinable period of time, you, as you know yourself, are not there. You are, you've gone outside of yourself. So ecstasy is actually a really good word in the English language based on its Latin derivation and stuff to use to describe the blissful feeling that is associated with that. So I guess what I'm telling you is there are different degrees and different intensities. And the different words people use, there's nothing special about particular words. Anybody might choose to use any word. They might choose to use the first rush of piti that you feel after you've been meditating for a little while as ecstasy, but that's their choice. It's not because there are words to denote the differences between these. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just want to know because Jack has a book talk about after ecstasy. So
oh, after the ecstasy, the laundry. Right. Yeah, right. And in that case, the ecstasy that he's referring to, have you read the book?
I have a book I haven't read.
Oh, you got to read it. It's a good book. It's a, you know. The ecstasy that he's referring to is the aftermath of a path attainment experience. And the laundry he's talking about is life goes on, you know. Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And as we talked about before, first path attainment produces a real transformation, but it doesn't go quite as far as some people might imagine. And so, of course, some of the laundry after the ecstasy is dirty laundry. And that's because sometimes spiritual teachers who have some degree of attainment, they can lose sight of what it is that they know at a deep level. They can slip back into the dream and not be lucid while they're doing it. As a matter of fact, I think that the best way to think of that term, seven times returner, is the fact that somebody who has achieved that first path can still slip back into samsara over their head for a little while. It won't last too long. They have a degree of wisdom that they'll catch on and they'll wake up again from the dream. So after the ecstasy, the laundry, it's also, a lot of it's about dirty laundry. Chop wood, carry water, and some of the things you do at the woodshed that you probably shouldn't. Yeah?
Just forgive me if this is a simple question, but I'm not, I mean, my interest in this wasn't with regard to any sort of PT or joy or meditative joy, not even like ordinary joy, certainly not enlightenment, that those are all very sort of far off, you know, for the heavy duty people who do this, like Deborah. But I mean, what I'm interested in is, and I'm going to assume that people here are also interested in it, I can't be too strange for it, is like a lot of people, I think, to ease up on the suffering, the craving, the resistance to pain, the resistance to reality, the whole stuff that we talked about. So if you could just, I don't know, maybe comment on what a regular meditation, a daily practice, daily insight meditation, mindfulness, how that affects those things. If you're not looking at the joy component, the enlightenment component.
I'd be very glad to. Repeat the question? Okay. What you were saying is that not everybody comes to meditation because they are interested in awakening or enlightenment or even some of the other rather wonderful things that come a bit later in the practice. That's absolutely true. As the Buddha said about this path and his teaching a number of times, and I'm really fond of repeating, it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. When you begin to meditate, it will give you better concentration and better mindful awareness, which will improve your ability to function in the world, in your job, at home, your relationships, and so forth. So it's good in the beginning in that way. I mean, for that matter, it'll lower your blood pressure and do a lot of other nifty stuff too. But it has very beneficial psychological effects for anybody that practices meditation properly. You're training your mind. Your mind is acquiring skills, and they're extremely valuable skills. Your mindfulness allows you to be more aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. It helps you to take advantage of that little gap between the sudden arising of an emotion and the words that come out of your mouth or the actions that you do. And it also allows you to enlarge that gap so that you can bring a lot more into your decision-making process than you would previously. So these are the good in the beginning kind of aspects. To have better concentration, better mindful awareness, improves across the board in your life. It's going to produce improvements. Some will be subtle and you won't necessarily notice them, unless after you've been meditating for a couple of years, something reminds you of the way you used to get road rage when somebody cut you off, and you realize, well, why do we do that anymore? Or something like that, you know. You often find relationships start to go better. There's the good in the middle part. That's when you get into the stages where there starts to be the kind of purification of mind that I talk about. It's the kind of meditation-induced psychotherapy that if you read books by Jack Kornfield and people like that, they're really fond of this aspect of meditation practice. Right? They love the idea that people can get in touch with their problems, they can learn to manage PTSD, they can learn to deal with grief or to manage depression or all kinds of other things like this. They can learn not to be so victimized by their childhood abuse. They can let it go and let it be something that happened a long time ago. They can get a handle on the parts of their mind and the processes taking place within them that make them prone to anger or prone to chemical or alcohol abuse or prone to excessive unwise sexual activity or all of the other kinds of things that, you know, that we do as human beings, and we do with the attitude of, you know, why am I like this? I wish I didn't do this, but I can't seem to change myself. And when you say meditation is good in the middle, when you go through the when you go through those middle stages, the purification of mind is it's a wonderful therapeutic process. And I don't know if you're personally aware of this or not, but meditation is starting to be used more and more as a therapeutic tool. You know, it's being taught in medical schools. Major hospitals are offering mindfulness-based stress reduction programs and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy programs, and the insurance companies and Medicare are paying for these things. So that's the good in the middle part of it. But I try to always encourage people to keep in mind what meditation really was developed for. That this technology is a means not to decrease slightly the suffering that's in your life. Although if you're dealing with some major life situations and meditation helps you to come to a resolution of them, I mean, that may seem like no small thing. But what meditation delivers in the beginning and what meditation delivers in the middle can be lost, can be overwhelmed. It, to preserve it depends on a lot of factors, and not the least of which, perhaps one of the most important of which, is that you continue in some kind of practice, because those exact same life circumstances and tendencies of your mind and personality that created those problems that you're now capable of dealing with, they're still there, and they'll catch up with you again. Okay? Not to mention, life is full of things that are still difficult to deal with. Death's there for everybody. And it's not just our own death, it's the death of the people we love. I mean, one of the important things to remember that the Buddha pointed out was that everything near and dear to you, without exception, everything that is near and dear to you will pass away. And absolutely anything that you cling to is going to be a cause of suffering. So what do you do? I mean, you could go live in a cave, not enter into any relationships, and, you know, things like that, but that's not much of a way to live. Mm-hmm. What the end of the path promises is that you can be in relationships with people. You can love people without the kind of clinging that's going to cause you to suffer. You can live in the world and meet your needs and function in a way that is enormously satisfying to you without being attached to what happens and how things turn out. You know, truly, the end of the path offers a kind of happiness that is totally independent of external circumstances and cannot be taken away from you. And the interesting thing about it is that as a part of that package, whether it's what you signed on for or not, it comes with a kind of wisdom. And the very essence of that wisdom is, if you have that wisdom, you have compassion. You know, you may have to learn to open up to it, you may have to learn to use it, but the very same thing that liberates for you from your suffering empowers you as a human being, and it gives you a purpose and a sense of compassion. One of the things that people like to ask in Dharma talks, you know, we talk about what it's like to be a Buddha, and the question comes up, why do Buddhas even get out of bed in the morning? They don't have any desire, aversion, you know. What's the point? But the thing is that with the wisdom comes compassion, with the compassion comes a reason to get out of bed. I mean, after the Buddha's enlightenment, he taught for 45 years. And he discusses very frankly, frankly in the sutras, the periods of doubt that he went through. When he does this, he personifies those parts of his mind that raise the question, well, why are you bothering to do all this, as someone named Mara, the tempter. But he relates in the sutras his discussions with Mara, the tempter. And Mara, the tempter, shows up, and the Buddha says, well, old friend, how? What are we up to now? You know. But Mara, right from the beginning, said to the Buddha, you've done what had to be done. Why hang around in this realm? You know. And fortunately for the rest of us, the Buddha, out of compassion, was motivated to stay in the world, spend 45 years, create a system of teaching, which unfortunately is really, really distorted now. I mean, what we get now, you have to really work to find out what it was that he was teaching. But it's incredible, nevertheless, even with its distortions. It is just absolutely amazing, the wisdom. But it's also a method, a path to achieve something yourself. You know, this thing that we did a little while ago, we took refuge in the Buddha. And you probably don't know exactly what that means, right? What on earth is taking refuge? This is our kind of worship, you know. It's like the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Or, right? It's not. Because when we go for refuge to the Buddha, it's not the person. It's the Buddha's enlightenment. The Buddha was a human being. In spite of all the stories of hundreds of millions of lifetimes perfecting himself so that he could be a Sammasambuddha Buddha, he was absolutely 100% a human being, just like you. And so part of our refuge is that a liberation such as he describes is possible by human beings through their own efforts, and he is a representative of that. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, we're going for refuge to the enlightenment of a Buddha, which is a possibility for ourselves. And we go for refuge to the Dharma because that's the teaching that he left as a legacy to help guide us. And we go for refuge to the Sangha because in the stories that have come down to us, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people that followed him and succeeded in achieving that same enlightenment. He once held a convocation at Vulture Hill where there were supposed to be 1,250 arhats present at one meeting. That's the fourth and highest level of enlightenment. You know, so part of our going for refuge to the enlightenment of the Buddha is going for refuge to a dharma that's been passed down to us that over the course of 2,500 years has allowed many other beings just like ourselves to succeed in becoming Buddhas. And then we take these refuges three times. You know, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha once, twice, three times. So the first time is sort of looking backwards. The second time, which is really important, is looking forward. An awful lot of people who come to meditation don't choose as their goal personal enlightenment or awakening, complete liberation, the true goal at the end of the process, because they don't believe it's possible. But because this path is good in the beginning and good in the middle, they're quite happy to settle for the beginning, maybe even the middle too. But the only reason that they don't dedicate themselves to achieving what is the ultimate purpose of the path, is because they doubt that they're capable of. And the unfortunate thing over 2,500 years is that the teaching has become distorted. And it has become a lot more difficult for people to follow this path and succeed at it. But if we look at the history of Buddhism as a part of our refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and the looking backwards, we'll see that it hasn't always been this difficult. Now, some people might tell you that, well, that's because back then everything was different. Today we're in a very degenerate age, and of course that's why we... But that's nonsense. The only thing that's degenerated is the quality of the information that's been passed down to us. The path is still just as feasible to complete and attain the final goal for very large numbers of people in a comparatively short period of time as it ever was. But it does take dedication. And so if I can convince you that it's worth, if you can say to yourself, well, if this is really true, boy, it sure is, it's what I'd like to do. This is what I'd like to dedicate my life to. So if I can convince you enough to overcome some of your innate doubt, you'll actually progress a lot more quickly through the beginning and the middle stages. And it is possible. And so, you know, that's why I talk about, I don't just talk about how is it going to make you more relaxed and happy and easier to deal with stress and all this other stuff. I want you to look to the future. The second time we go for refuge to the Buddha, we're going for refuge to our own future Buddhahood, our own future complete and total enlightenment. That's what we're doing. And refuge, just to mention, the word refuge. To go for refuge means that we need to have something of an awareness of just what a difficult, sticky situation we are in as human beings. The existential dilemma that is life, the degree to which we seem to be condemned to so much suffering and so much loss. And not only that, we come into this world to do what? Well, we get married and have kids so that what? Our kids can grow up and be neurotic and have trouble getting jobs and have failures in marriage. So that they can have kids. And it's like, ooh, what is this all about anyway? You know. You go to refuge because you realize that there's some basic problems with this. Not that life is bad, existence is bad, or things like that, but there's some very real, very profound, very pervasive problems with this. This is why you go for refuge. So on the second round of refuge, we're looking to the future. We're going for refuge to our own future enlightenment. That's where we're rousing in ourselves our confidence, our faith, our determination, our willingness to adhere to the practice, to do what needs to be done. Likewise, we go for refuge to the Dharma. Dharma has, one meaning of Dharma is the teachings that we follow, but another meaning of Dharma is the ultimate truth. And so when we're going for refuge the second time, we're going for refuge to our own realization of Dharma in the sense of ultimate truth, the attainment of that wisdom. And the Sangha that we go for refuge to the third time is the Sangha of all of the enlightened beings, the Aryan Sangha, it was called, the Sangha of the noble ones who have completed the path. The third time we go for refuge, the Buddha that we're going for refuge to is our own Buddha nature. Whatever it is inside us that brings us to the practice and that has somehow guided us to where we are, that inner wisdom, and that is going to ensure that indeed we can complete this path. We go for refuge to the Dharma in the sense of our own personal practice, our daily study, meditation, reflection, things like that, to remind us and encourage us to try to sustain an effective practice and to really make this the priority in our life. And we go for refuge to the Sangha, which is all of us here in the room and all the people in the world, ordained, not ordained, teachers, students, whatever, who have some appreciation of this path and this Dharma, and who, to greater or lesser degrees, support each other in their pursuit of it. So I'm trying to encourage everybody who comes to meditation for the things that make it good in the beginning to consider that maybe they can enjoy the things that make it good in the middle, and maybe even be willing to take a stab at what makes it good in the end. I'm not sure that's exactly what you were looking for. Maybe you were just wanting me to tell you some of the good things that will come from meditation. And I already know from talking to you, you've already discovered some of them. And they're kind of impressive. Would you not agree? Yeah? Right. And that's just the beginning. How long have you been meditating?
4 days.
Can you imagine what it'll be like if you keep this up for 4 years? Yeah. So, lots of wonderful benefits from it. The reason that I wanted to talk about PT in this retreat is that if you understand what PT is, and if you know the role that it can play, then you can begin to cultivate it and utilize it in your practice right from the beginning. And I've already given you some pointers in that direction, but I want to talk more about how you do that. Because you see, the reason that I got into teaching, I had no intention of teaching. I mean, we moved to a little isolated canyon in southeast Arizona to leave the world behind. Recluses, you know, I'll do my practice on my own, you know. And I knew there were all these wonderful meditation centers out there, IMS and everything else. And I assumed, that's great. Those people are, you know, good for them. But I wasn't interested in getting involved in the teaching thing. But then people started coming to me and asking if they could meditate with me and asking for instruction. And believe me, when I started giving instruction, I was not very good at it. Because, you know, it doesn't matter if you've been meditating for 35 years. If you haven't tried to teach somebody else, what you've got to learn is how to teach somebody else. Which is totally different. It involves things like, you know what you've come through, but do you know how you did it? And a lot of that I did, some of that I knew and some of that I didn't really know and I had to discover. But what got me interested in teaching was realizing that there were all these people out there, the ones that had been going to all these retreats for years and years, that I thought, you know, they must be just rejoicing in all the benefits of all this meditation they've been doing. But find out most of them didn't know how to meditate. 15 years practicing, been to 2 week, 3 week, month long retreats every year for the last 15 years, and they don't even know how to meditate yet. So that's why I got interested in teaching.
Yeah. I don't want to be that person.
No, you don't want to be that person. And it amazes me, some of the people that have stuck with it as long as they have, because they've made meditation into this grueling experience that requires enormous self-discipline. You not only have to give up all the fun things that you might have done in the time that you spend meditating, you know, going to a resort at Cabo San Lucas instead of going to a retreat, you know, all this sort of stuff. But sitting there and experiencing meditation as hard and experiencing the frustration that they're doing it a long time and still not getting the results that they expected and all of this sorts of things. I have to admire those people that have stuck with meditation. But you see, it doesn't have to be like that. Meditation should be a positive experience pretty well from the beginning, and it should just get better. And part of the secret of that is to make your meditation joyful. And the joy you start out with isn't the PT that we call meditative joy, but it contributes to that, it leads to that, and it helps you to develop the kind of concentration and mindfulness that permits the unification of mind that leads to this PT that people call rapture and bliss and ecstasy and stuff like that. But you don't have to wait for it. As I mentioned to you a couple of times, it's not something that you grind away at for 20 years and then someday, oh, there's the PT at last. Oh, about time. It's not like that. You can start cultivating it right from the beginning. And that's what I want to communicate. And that's what I help everybody to make a part of their practice. I'd like everybody to realize that whenever you say to yourself or to someone else, oh, meditation is hard, this is a great opportunity to look at that. So, okay, well, what do I mean by hard? What makes it hard? I'm setting expectations that I'm not meeting. And I'm beating myself up because I'm not meeting my own expectations. Therefore, it's hard. Right? Or I'm asking myself to do something that is not terribly enjoyable. And therefore, making myself do it is hard. And I don't want people to do that. I want people to enjoy their meditation. I want them to learn to enjoy their life. And as a matter of fact, if you learn the same principles that will allow you to learn to enjoy your meditation rather than make it an onerous labor, will allow you to make your life more joyful as well as you go through your life doing the things that you set out to do. Yes?
I know a couple of days you talked about some of those principles. Mm-hmm. But would you go through some of them or elaborate more on them?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are the basic things to do to bring that joy in, to meditation, okay, to life?
Well, the interesting thing, they're really very simple. And the most basic one is, begin to act as though you were already in a state of joy. And that's why I wanted to refresh in your memories. I should get you to all repeat, 100,000 times. What is it about a state of joy? So that you remember. But a joyful person is far more aware of the positive things in their environment, the positive things in their body, the positive things in their mind. A sad person, a person in one of these other states, is going to be aware of different things. A sad person is going to be aware of what's painful, what's ugly, what's dirty, what's broken. An angry person is going to be aware of what's annoying, what's, all that kind of stuff. Act as though you're already a joyful person. Keep an eye on yourself. This is the mindfulness part. When you find yourself looking at, observing, paying attention to negative things, there are always positive things present. There's always something beautiful. I was trying to make you aware of this the other night. When you look in your body, you'll find pain. Yep, you're going to find pain. Except, although there's a certain stage of meditation you get where you won't anymore. And I promise you that's one of the things you can look forward to. But until you get there, anytime you look in your body, you're going to find pain. But don't stop there. And this is what I was asking you to do the other night. Look in your body and you'll find there is also pleasant feeling. There's always both. There's always both. And you have, there's all kinds of things that you imagine you have control over and that you imagine you can do. But there is one thing that you, as an individual, do have some real influence over, and that is where your attention is directed. And so you can choose to direct your attention at positive things and away from negative things. And so that's the beginning point. That is the first point. When, no matter where you are, what situation you are, whether you're sitting and meditating, whether you're doing walking meditation, whether you're driving your car, whether you're at work, there are beautiful things around you. As problematic as it is, this planet that we live on is so incredibly beautiful that it's astounding. It's astounding that we can shut that fact out so much, so completely, so much of the time. All you have to do is open yourself up to it. And there is beauty everywhere. And there is goodness everywhere. And what you're working towards, I mean, one of the insights that you'll experience if you stay on this path past the middle stages is you will realize, I don't mean figure out, I mean realize directly that absolutely everything is perfect. That's how good it really is. But just to begin with, there's always goodness. There's always beauty. There's always something that you can selectively direct your attention towards rather than what's ugly and unpleasant. So that's the first thing, is to practice doing that. It will strengthen your skill in mindfulness, because the only way that you can do that is to have some part of your mind keeping track of what you're paying attention to, some part of your mind keeping track of the mental states and the moods that are present. But those are the ones that key to you. You know, as I said, what the Buddha's first teaching on the First Noble Truth tells us, or first two Noble Truths tells us, is wherever you're experiencing suffering or unhappiness, if you look, you'll find there's some craving, there's some process of rejecting what is. So if you just practice being aware of what's happening in your mind and knowing that you do have the power to attend to things that are more positive, more conducive to love and joy and happiness. That's the first thing. And then, so you're acting as though you're already, that your mind was already in a state of joy. When you're in a state of joy, it does this automatically. You do it deliberately, and it begins to trigger a state of joy. And if you manage to, the more that you're able to induce a state of joy by deliberately paying attention to the good, the beautiful, the wholesome, then the more your mind's going to enter into a true state of joy, which reinforces that. You've got kind of a positive feedback loop going. The second thing is, whatever it is you're paying attention to, try to see it in its most positive aspects. Okay? And then the third thing is, when you find yourself experiencing the vaguenesses of unpleasantness, look and see, you know, am I so completely entrenched in that? Or can I do what the Buddha invited us to do? He said, when there is unpleasantness, look for the craving that is causing it. Find the craving and see if you can let it go just for a moment. You know, and it may be that it's just for a moment, and if you expected more, you'll be disappointed. So don't expect more, and don't disappoint yourself. Instead, realize that if you repeat this, if you just keep reaffirming this, you know, I'm miserable. Okay, why am I making myself miserable? Let me let go of that. That story, if you can find what your story is that is doing a number on you, and let go of it for a minute, that leaves an imprint. And if you do that enough times, that imprint gets to be of pretty serious proportions. this will move you towards a state of joy in every part of your life. When you're meditating, what you should do is be aware of whatever experience you're having that's positive. Whatever parts of your body don't hurt. But particularly if you start out, usually when you first sit down, at least this is the way it is with me, sometimes it's hard to remember how it was 30 years ago. But the way it is with me, when I first sit down, you know, and I just relax and let go, it is delightful. I could not pay attention to that. I could not notice. But, I mean, right now, is there not something wonderful about the way it feels? And if you go into stillness, when the body is still, it has a special, it's a delicious quality, doesn't it? No? Yeah, it is. And the things that I notice when I direct my attention to my body is, you know, the pressure produced by the weight of my body on this cushion, I could just see it as, you know, a sensation and label it pressure. But it's actually the loving embrace between this Mother Earth and this bag of fluids here, you know, that came from this Mother Earth. And I find it really easy to experience it that way when I feel the earth supporting my body. And it's, yeah, you know, I'm being embraced by the Mother. She's not letting me float off into outer space. Well, that may be kind of silly, but... but it's true, you know. And when you breathe, the air, the air is delicious. It has these different feels and temperatures and things like that. So when I sit down and meditate, boy, there's all kinds of wonderful, pleasant experience. And if I remember to tap into them right away, then I get that momentum going from that. And so then, you know, as I go a little bit deeper then, you know, if when my mind settles into watching the breath, then I immediately feel that calmness, that there's a kind of coolness that comes, that coolness of mind. And it's pleasant. Easy to disregard. It's a little bit subtle. And so it's very easy to disregard, but what I'm saying is don't disregard it. Pay attention to it. The fact that your still body and your still mind feel good, and that you've noticed that, and maybe even taken a brief little moment to just savor it and enjoy it. All these other mental processes with different agendas, it gets their attention a little bit. You know, in terms of the herd of cats in your head, it's a whiff of tuna fish that says, something's happening in that direction. So it starts moving things in the right direction. And so just keep doing that. We talked about making your meditation into a flow activity, which, you know, and it's good to review. What are the characteristics of a flow activity? Well, you let go of everything else. You forget everything else, and you're just doing this. To make meditation a flow activity is really good to remind yourself, say, okay, for the next whatever you set your timer for, 45 minutes now, this is for me. The rest of the world has no claim. You know, this is my time. This is for me. Right? So, you let go of all that other stuff. And it's going to try to come back. Well, I don't have to tell you that. You've been fighting it. It's going to try to come back. But you get off to the right start that you know, you don't need it. You can let go of it. You're trying to get fully present with what's happening. And your mind coming up with all these thoughts of other things, that's just part of what's happening. But you don't have to pay attention to that part of what's happening. You can just let it go on. You create the meditation as a flow experience. And so you know how to do the practice. It's simple to do. It only becomes hard if you start laying expectations on yourself and feeling disappointed because you don't meet them, or beating yourself up because your mind wandered. Well, you know, this is all, you get caught in this illusion that I'm in control, I am real, I want this, I'm going to do this. Oh, I didn't do that. Oh, why am I doing this? Well, you know, if you have to ask, why am I doing this, then whichever part of I is asking is not the same part that's doing the doing. So you don't need to, that part of yourself doesn't need to beat itself up about it, or even the other part of yourself for that matter. You know. It becomes a flow experience where you've got a really simple task, and this is one of the things I want to convey as clearly as possible. Your task, what you're actually capable of doing, is extremely simple. You just have to formulate the intention to bring your attention back to the meditation object. Now, as we advance in the stages and your skill becomes greater, what you do with your intention becomes a bit more sophisticated. But all you do in the entire process is generate and hold an intention. And when some other part of your mind makes something else happen, you don't get in a big fight with it. You just go back to your original intention and you keep doing this. And every time you do this, it's a victory. So if you set that as your standard, if you say to yourself, I'm going to sit here for 10 minutes without my mind wandering, and your mind wanders, well, you've lost. But if you say, as soon as I realize my mind wanders, I'm going to let it go and gently bring my attention back, you really can't lose. Because if you bring your attention back, you've won. If your mind wanders 50 times, you've won 50 times. So, you know, make it a flow experience. And remember, a flow experience is where you challenge yourself. Can't be too easy. You've got to be doing the best you can. But you don't expect more than you're capable of actually doing. And you gauge your success by something that is immediately realizable, not something that will happen an hour later. And then it becomes a flow experience. And then you can sit there and the meditation, this combination of making it pleasant, making it enjoyable, making it your time, making it a success story because this is something that you're capable of doing. And so since you're capable of doing, you're going to do it to the very, very best of your ability. You see, these are the ingredients, all of the ingredients for creating joy and making meditation joyful. And if you do that, you won't find yourself dreading the next sit. And the better you get at it, the more likely you are to look forward to the next sit. And then you start to have this attitude towards each sit, you know, because your mind's going to play all kinds of games, it's going to do all kinds of different things, it's going to throw all kinds of different things up. So now it becomes, well, I wonder what's going to happen this time. You know, not something that I want this to happen and I don't want that to happen. It's just like, okay, this is going to be interesting. See what happens this time. Maybe it'll be something completely new. Maybe it won't. Yes?
What you were talking about before the break, about how your job is easy. You know, you just form the intention to focus on the breathing, and then when you realize it's wandered, you simply bring it back. And so those are both things that you can do, and therefore it's easy, and you can call each one of those a success. Mm-hmm. So you can create flow. So here's some things that happen to me that make it not so easy.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts out easy,
mm-hmm.
and I do those things. And two things generally occur. One is that I get restless.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I decided that going down and making that cup of coffee sure sounds good right now. And it's hard to resist that activity that seems so much better than this one. And the other thing that happens, and I'll say them both together because I think they relate, is that doing that activity, bringing your mind back to the breathing, you know you're doing it because it will have some effect that at some point your mind will wander less and stay in place longer. And even without a particular expectation, like I'm going to not wander for 10 minutes, even mm-hmm. without a particular expectation, when it goes a real long time and you don't see an improvement,
mm-hmm.
that makes it really tough. It makes that cup of coffee sound even better.
Well, a couple of different things that I would say. First of all, I can give you for instances and for examples, but what's most important is for you to find the way that you can make your meditation most enjoyable. I mean, that's my bottom line message, is the more enjoyable that you are able to make your meditation, the more successful you're going to be in the practice, right? And, you know, so it's up to you to figure out the things. And the other thing is, if you drink an extra cup of coffee or whatever it is, and you experience restlessness, then if you could think of this as a learning opportunity, I don't want it to sound trite. You know, I mean, people will tell you that life is a school and everything that happens is an opportunity to learn. And that can be a bit annoying. But annoying or not, there is a very important element of truth in that. And in terms of your meditation, although the immediate object may be to practice in a particular way, the larger goal is to come to understand your mind and the nature of reality. This is reality. Here you are, boom. I've got an example of reality. I'm supposed to be sitting here, and I got all this caffeine jazzing me up. So, let me pay attention to what's going on there in my mind and all the different layers. I feel restless, and then how do I feel about feeling restless? Words get kind of awkward, but you know what I mean. How am I reacting to the experience of being restless? Am I identifying with it? To what degree is my identifying with it as I am restless rather than restlessness is arising, affecting the experience that I'm having? Now, I'm just giving you for instances, but I'm saying that if you could look at it as an opportunity rather than as a disaster, yeah, okay? Also, there, a really valuable practice is learning to look at your mind's reaction to your success in this process. Now, if you don't see any progress for a long period of time, you really should be checking to find out whether there's anything wrong with the way you're practicing. You know, because I mean, sometimes that's a possibility. But when you're satisfied that you are practicing more or less basically in the way that has worked for other people, then it becomes more a situation of, once again, being able to go with what is. You know, you don't know how long it's going to be before you start to enjoy the particular fruits and benefits that you're hoping for. That nobody knows that. That's just a completely unknown. But if you have some trust and confidence that what you're doing will get you there in the end, you know, then it's a journey. You keep taking another step and another step and another step. And yes, like on a journey, you start on a long hike. I've had this happen to me on a hike, and I'm sure I should have been there by now. Right. And when am I ever going to get there? And I wonder if I'm on the wrong path. Maybe I'm not going anywhere. So it's natural to have those kinds of feelings arise. But those feelings they're part of your reality. That's the reality you have in the moment. You know, maybe after this it's over with, you can check to see whether your practice is okay. You consider doing some different kind of practice. But right now, you can't do that and sit there at the same time. So you can either sit there and let your doubts detract from the quality of your present moment experience, or you can take the best advantage of your present moment experience. Does this make sense to you?
Well, I think what you're saying is hang in there.
Well, I'm definitely saying hang in there, but I'm saying don't grit your teeth and hang in there. Try to adjust your attitude so that hanging in there isn't really such a bad thing to do. It's an interesting opportunity. Treat it as an opportunity, as a potential for a more rewarding experience. And there's no guarantee that it's going to become that, but at least it becomes possible when you do that.
And just to come from the other side too, you know, it's not all bleak. You know, like I've done well this week.
Yeah.
Monday aside, but the lesson I've learned this week so far, in cases is helpful to anybody. If you want to make your whole sit enjoyable, figure out how to make one breath enjoyable.
That is a brilliant discovery. That is fabulous. I give you a whole page of gold stars for that one. Yeah. That's right. One breath at a time. One moment at a time. Yeah. And there's a really profound truth in that that goes beyond to everything else in life. Happiness is not in the future or the past. It's right now. So if you're going to get any happiness, this is where you've got to get it. It's the only place it's available. So, yeah. So thank you for that one. I'm sure that'll help a lot of people. Yeah.
While you're doing this analysis, as Neil was talking about, evaluation analysis, what happens to the breathing? How long do you let go of breathing and don't pay attention to breathing because you're doing all this analysis?
Well, the way I'd like you to do it is not a logical analysis, but more as an open opportunity for observation. You see, one way that we have of knowing and learning things is to focus in on specifics and then manipulate the relationships between these specifics and come up with meaningful solutions. This is what we call discursive thinking. But it's not the only way to learn things, and for some kinds of things, it's not even a particularly good way. If you want to understand the nature of your mind, you have to watch it with something of a broader perspective. And let me just point out something to you. If you have the focus of your attention on your breath, then you are conscious of more than just what is at the focus of your attention. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Right. That's what's really important. We really have two ways of processing information. One is this very focused, self-centered, analytical, highly conceptual way. And the other is a more open, holistic, not very conceptual way. And that's what I want you to look at your mind with, is that if you put your attention on the breath, but things are going on in your mind, well, what you can do, don't move your attention and focus your attention on your mind. Keep your attention on your breath to take some of that consciousness. Think of it like a light. You've got this illuminating power of consciousness, and it's all focused right there. So what I want you to do is take as much of that as you can afford to, as much of that focused consciousness as you can, and distribute it in this other kind of awareness, and just watch yourself and watch your mind.
So then what you're saying, you're focusing on your breath, but in your peripheral vision, you're kind of seeing what is going on in the background. You're doing that now.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, I got interested in all the birds around where I live a few years ago. And I had such a time trying to tell one bird from another and remember their names, and it was very difficult. Tried for a little while. And then I just gave up, but I loved watching them, and so I watched them. And after a while, without making any effort at all, I just got to know them. And I could tell one from the other. And without ever, in my recollection, having thought about it analytically in the least, I came to know the kind of behavior that was specific to certain kinds of birds. I just absorbed that just through watching the birds, but without thinking about them, without analyzing them, and often with the focus of my attention somewhere else. And that's really the way you have to discover the nature of your own mind, is you have to use this other capacity that can absorb information in a more holistic way. As soon as you start to try to focus on your mind, you're also going to start making up stories about what it is you're seeing, and it's going to keep you from seeing what's really there. Okay? So yeah, the peripheral vision, that's what you want to use. And that's what you want to learn to be able to use more effectively, you know. In your daily life, let me go back to the analogy. I think of consciousness as if it were a kind of illumination, using light as a metaphor for it. And you can imagine that you've got a spotlight with a tightly focused beam, and you've got a floodlight. And you've only got so much juice available to go through these two different lights. So if all the juice is going into the spotlight, there's this one little area that's illuminated and everything else is in the dark. If all of it's going to the floodlight, then you've got a huge area that is just barely illuminated. So, but what you have to work with is you can go back and forth between these two. What's even more valuable, one of the things that happens as a direct result of this meditation process, is the available wattage increases. So you can get to the point where you know, if you spread the beam this big, everything's in just a dim light from where you started with. But if you increase the wattage enough, you can spread it that big, and it's now almost as brightly illuminated as you once would have been able to do, only with using your spotlight in a small area. So there's two things in this. You have to learn to use both the spotlight and the floodlight and to direct the available illuminating power of consciousness between the two according to your needs. But the other thing in your practice is you're going to increase the total available power, or power of conscious awareness. The reason that we have trouble practicing mindful awareness in our daily life is we say, okay, here I am, I'm practicing mindfulness, I'm mindfully driving to work, mindfully walking in the door, mindfully hanging up my jacket, and then get hit with something that requires all of the illuminating power of consciousness, and now that's all that exists. And no more of this nice mindful awareness that we were cultivating. So we learn skill in managing what we've got, but we also increase what we've got available to work with. And that's what mindfulness practice is about. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, we were talking about the watcher.
Yes.
Well, I discovered that I can mindfully watch. This has to do with distractions, okay? Mm-hmm. I can mindfully watch myself doing the dishes or riding a bicycle or creating a painting. But what I found is I cannot mindfully watch my distractions. And I would like to be able to mindfully watch my distractions, because it is easy. When I try to do that, whatever, the watcher disappears. Mm-hmm. And it's just the distraction. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I go back to watching again, the distraction goes. But I want to be able to do both.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I'll bet you everybody in the room can relate to what you're saying. How do you watch the distractions? And it's because you got to watch the distractions out of the corner of your mind's eye. Because if you focus, you can't watch those distractions by focusing your attention on them. It just doesn't work. To go back to the spotlight and the floodlight analogy, we're talking about lights, but who is doing the perceiving of what's illuminated? That's the watcher, right? And you want to keep in this place where the watcher is able to see both. So you can't use that spotlight kind of attention. You've got to use that floodlight kind of awareness. The distinction I make is that I call one attention and I call the other awareness, because awareness is a more general term. You know, but it's your peripheral vision. It has a very good counterpart in the way that our actual eyes work. If you focus on a single object, and you can intentionally expand your visual awareness and to take in a whole lot. And that's the only way that you can watch certain kinds of things. You can't observe them by focusing your eye on them. You've got to stop your eye moving and open up your visual awareness. And this is the same thing you have to do in your mind in order to have that experience of watching your distractions, because there are myriad distractions and they're constantly changing and they're interacting with each other. And if you focus your attention on one of them, now you've become part of the dance rather than the watcher. Right? So, I hope you find that helpful.
I'll let you know.
All right. But peripheral vision is a good analogy. So, peripheral vision of mind, peripheral conscious awareness. Okay.